I'm Tess Vigeland. It's finally here, decision time for Election 08. On the issue of health care, voters are weighing options that sound good in a stump speech against reality.
I know what it costs just for me on Medicare, and I don't believe that those tax credits are going to cover it.
Investors appeared to believe this week that the Fed's interest rate cut might help solve the credit crisis, but others see a black lining in the cloud.
Lower interest rates is going to punish people who are saving money and encourage more of the reckless borrowing and spending that is the reason we're in this mess.
And we'll visit a bank that's been far from reckless in its lending practices, requiring up to 50% down on its loans.
You deal with quality borrowers that you know, because integrity and character are what come through in troubled times.
That story and more coming up as we continue our coverage of fallout from the financial crisis on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. If only the economy was a funhouse mirror, then things wouldn't seem too creepy. We'd know it was just a distorted image, unreflecting of reality. But no, more signs this Halloween that reality is just as ghoulish. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
So the economy contracted a wicked 0.3% in the third quarter. It's the first decline in gross domestic product since 2001. Instead of donning a fright wig and running screaming like a banshee into the blackened forest, Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke presided over yet another interest rate cut, this time to within striking distance of zero. The central bank is trying to make it cheaper for businesses and you to borrow money. John Dimsdale looks at whether it's just another trick or a sweet treat to unwind the goblins in the credit markets.
When the credit crisis began in the summer of 2007, the overnight lending rate was 5.25%. And ever since, the Fed has aggressively pushed interest rates lower to kickstart the faltering economy. Ira Kamenow, a former member of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve, says it'll take a while for the central bank's rate cuts to filter down to the consumer level. For example, credit card interest charges still reflect tight credit conditions. However, immediately after Wednesday's Fed action, several commercial banks lowered the prime rate they charge their best customers, which Kamenow says should benefit homebuyers, especially those with adjustable rate mortgages.
It's going to help all those interest rates that are tied, for example, to the bank prime rate, and that's going to help encourage people to borrow a little more, perhaps.
But Kamenow and other economists worry the Fed has become overzealous in its rate-cutting fervor. Villanova Business School Professor Victor Lee says extremely low rates could encourage more of the same bad loans that got us in this crisis in the first place.
If you keep rates too low for too long, it may encourage the additional risk-taking that occurred during, for example, when Alan Greenspan was chairman of the Fed. And one of the things that people point to is that he had kept those rates too low for too long, and that may have contributed to the current situation.
Even with short-term rates at a record low, Fed board members say they're still worried about the economy and signal they might cut again in December. But Gerald O'Driscoll, a former vice chairman of the Dallas Fed, says today's central bankers have just about run out of ammunition.
There's not much further they can go. They can go to zero, and the Japanese did that in the 90s at one point. But, you know, this is an election year, and they have to be seen to be doing everything they can do. So I think they're being aggressive.
O'Driscoll says loosening the interest rate screws is the Fed's best tool for avoiding recession. But others, like Peter Schiff, the president of Euro-Pacific Capital, say the Fed is turning the screws in the wrong direction.
What the U.S. economy needs is the opposite. We need for Americans to stop borrowing. We need Americans to start saving their money. And lower interest rates is going to punish people who are saving money and encourage more of the reckless borrowing and spending that is the reason we're in this mess.
Schiff says the Fed's easy money policies are repeating Japan's mistakes when that country propped up banks that were poorly managed and should have been allowed to fail. The result, he says, has been nearly two decades of anemic economic growth. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace Money.
Mark Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at gather.com. Marketplace Money is supported by saveandinvest.org, helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. Online at saveandinvest.org.
The sickness afflicting the nation's economy is apparently pushing more people to forgo health care. A recent poll from the Kaiser Family Foundation showed the number of people putting off necessary medical care is up from 29% in April to 36% this month. Other surveys show elective surgeries are down, so are the number of prescriptions being filled. And all of these are seen as side effects of the growing ranks of unemployed people and a jump in out-of-pocket costs. Danielle Carson profiles one American whose medical condition has left her struggling with a stack of doctor's bills.
On August 9, 2001, Imitri Bean's life changed forever. That day, the 42-year-old lawyer suffered a burst brain aneurysm. She's had two strokes since and has epileptic seizures. Imitri lives in Bealeton, Virginia, with her 12-year-old daughter. It's a picturesque rural part of the state, but it's been anything but serene for Imitri.
I'm just asking that I can go to a hospital without worrying, how much is this going to cost me? I would like to get new glasses. Is that like a lot to ask? Every time I get an MRI, I'm laying there thinking, oh my God, how much is this costing? But I have to have that MRI in order to live.
Imitri lives on less than $2,200 a month in Social Security disability payments. She stretches that to cover her rent, utilities, and groceries. That money also covers her Medicare insurance premiums. But her insurance doesn't cover eyeglasses or dental care. She hasn't seen a dentist in 4 years. And
I was on the newest medications, but they weren't covered. And so I'm not on those for my seizures anymore.
A recent poll finds most Americans share Imitri's frustrations about their health insurance. Senator McCain's plan would scrap the current system where most people are covered through their jobs. Instead, they would shop around for a health plan. McCain's plan would let families take $5,000 off their federal tax bill and use it to buy insurance. That way, millions more could afford health insurance for the first time. Jonathan Oberlander is a visiting scholar at the Russell Sage Foundation in New York City.
It is a refundable tax credit rather than a deduction. So a refundable tax credit will give people money, even those who don't pay any taxes.
But for Imitri to sign up, she would have to drop Medicare. And she says that $5,000 federal check doesn't impress her.
I know what it costs to have health insurance every year. I know what it costs just for me on Medicare. And I don't believe that those tax credits are going to cover it.
Senator Obama's plan would let people keep their employer insurance. The uninsured could buy coverage through a government-sponsored program. Sarah Rosenbaum is a health policy analyst with George Washington University's School of Public Health. She says once you create a group market for the uninsured, it could be expanded to include the underinsured like Imitri. She thinks McCain's plan would be too risky.
This is the kind of person the individual market runs away from. No one would sell a product to her. She might end up in a high-risk pool somewhere, and the premiums would be so high, she'd be no better off than she is today. She couldn't possibly afford it.
Imitri says her 18-year-old daughter, who's in college, is covered through her father's plan. But when she thinks of her 12-year-old, she leans towards Obama's plan.
Senator Obama's plan talked about preventive health care. And when I think about a health care plan, it's not just for me, it's also for my daughter. And one of the things that helps me is for her to be healthy. That relieves a lot of stress when I'm not worrying about how she's doing.
Both candidates support preventive care and electronic record keeping to contain costs. Analysts say such initiatives will help, but there's little evidence they'll save money in the short term. Jonathan Oberlander.
This type of cost control is what I like to call faith-based cost control because it is based more on faith than evidence.
Until a new administration fleshes out the details, it's hard to say whether either plan can really deliver, especially on voters' biggest worry, punching a hole in ballooning health insurance premiums. In Washington, I'm Danielle Carson for Marketplace Money.
and this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's time for the audio op-ed we call The Straight Story, and with me is our own economics editor, Chris Farrell. Chris, how are you doing? How are you feeling these days? You feeling good?
Well, you know, okay, here's some wood in the studio, knocking on wood. I feel good. How about you?
I'm feeling pretty good myself. I suppose we're both very lucky that we have health insurance, just in case.
That's right. There are a lot of Americans that are uninsured, and there are a lot of Americans that are going to lose their insurance as we sink into a recession.
Well, let me ask you this. You have been saying for quite some time now, in fact, I think you even predicted at the beginning of the year that healthcare would be the dominant issue of this presidential campaign. I challenged you on that. I said, I've heard that before. I don't think it's actually going to happen. And well, my friend, here we are. It is not the dominant issue.
Yes. Well, the bailout is a dominant issue, and the bailout will dominate the first 100 days of whomever becomes president. But my fearless forecast is that healthcare is not going to disappear, and that healthcare will remain a top issue for the next president. I think Washington wishes the healthcare issue would disappear because it's so controversial and hard to deal with. It won't.
So what do you think is finally going to get this issue on the front burner? I mean, it kind of seems to get there and then it falls off a little bit and then it comes back and then it falls away. And we're always constantly hearing that, well, we just don't have the money for it.
No one can ever say again, we can't afford health care reform. Hello? We just spent, what, $700 billion bailing out the banking system? The consequence of this credit crunch, market meltdown, whatever you want to call it, is a recession, higher unemployment. The ranks of the uninsured will grow, and people who have health insurance, their premiums are going to go up, their deductibles are going to go up, and you're not going to be getting a pay raise. So it's going to be a real squeeze on the bottom line. I think this is a big bottom line household pocketbook issue that people are going to be squeezed.
Let me continue to press you on this because we went through a recession just, what, 7 years ago, where lots of people lost their jobs and therefore rejoined the ranks of the uninsured. Nothing happened then.
Oh, you're absolutely right. But the trend has gotten worse. For example, workers pay an average, there's a new survey out that workers are paying an average of about $3,500 toward family coverage. Now, that's more than double than what they paid 9 years ago. More than double. The problem has gotten worse, but neither candidate is abandoning it. I think we all realize coming out of the bailout that one of the big issues facing this country is going to be the budget deficit. It really boils down to one word, healthcare. Healthcare is the big driver and will continue to be the big driver when we're talking about the budget, because healthcare is 1/7 of the U.S. economy. It's a lot of money. There's a lot of competing interests there, but can't sweep it under the rug. You just can't do it any longer.
The Straight Story from our own Chris Farrell. Hey, thanks so much, Chris. You ready to take some calls later in the show?
It's my favorite part.
All right. When it comes to the health of your investments, the advice we're getting and giving these days is just don't look. Spare yourself from the agony of a 401k balance that's more like a 1k. But not everyone has followed that advice.
I would refresh the Google business page or the Yahoo Finance page 100 times a day would not be an exaggeration.
He's found a more zen approach to the Dow recently. We'll hear about it next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. Reports this week say a rescue plan is in the works for borrowers who are behind on their mortgages. No official word yet, though. There are all kinds of ideas floating around about how to get some of the bailout money to individuals, not just banks. New York Times columnist Joe Nocera has been writing about some of those ideas. And Joe, let's start with one from investment banker Bill Hambricht.
What he wants is that in return for reducing the mortgage payments for a borrower, the lender gets equity in the house so that at the point at which the house begins to appreciate again, the lender has some appreciation just as the borrower does. So it's a way to say to the borrower, look, you made a bunch of mistakes. And you're going to have to pay a price for that. But you get to stay in the house. You even get to own the house. But you have to give an ownership share of your house to the bank in return for him renegotiating your mortgage and bringing it down to an amount that you can pay.
That assumes, then, that at some point the home's value will go up enough for the bank to get back some of that equity when it sells. But what happens if it doesn't? Or do we even worry about that at this point?
Nobody's got every fine point nailed down here. People have thrown ideas out there that they think will help. Well, what is the goal here? It is not to save the lender. The goal is to keep people in their homes. Until you stem foreclosures, you will continue to have a financial system in peril because that's the root cause. All these mortgage-backed securities on Wall Street that everybody's calling toxic, the reason they're toxic is because people are foreclosing on Main Street.
Just as a side note, you mentioned, you know, the mortgage-backed securities, and I think one of the elements that has kept some banks from actually working with borrowers is that they are afraid of getting sued by the folks who hold mortgage-backed securities. Is that dealt with in these plans? I mean, would you basically say, no, you can't sue?
Well, in my favorite plan, it is dealt with.
And that would be the Freedom Recovery Plan, I assume.
That would be the Freedom Recovery Plan. And this is from a guy named Daniel Alpert, who I've gotten to know during the crisis because he's been very smart. So he sent me this plan, and I really, what I like about it is it doesn't cost the government any money. It inflicts some pain on both borrower and lender, so there's not a moral hazard issue. And I actually think it would work on a broad scale. The homeowner has an option. They can keep paying their mortgage, or they can walk into the bank or the lender and hand them the deed and say, you own the house, okay? And why would you do that? You would do it for one of two reasons. You got one of those arms and you can't pay the mortgage anymore and you're drowning and you're going to be foreclosed on. And the second kind of person who would do this, people with negative equity, people who the value of their homes have gone way down and they put no money down, so they don't have a big equity stake, and they're thinking about just walking away because it's just not worth it to hold on to that house anymore.
Even if they can technically afford to pay the mortgage.
Even if they can technically afford the mortgage payments. I mean, there are people who are making this economic calculus. So what does the homeowner get in return for turning in the deed? Under this plan, a law would be passed requiring the lender to accept the deed. They get their collateral, so there's no property rights being violated. However, they have to allow the borrower to stay in the home for up to 5 years, paying rent. And then after 5 years, assuming the homeowner has their you-know-what together, and they have enough to make a 10% down payment, they can buy the house back.
And if they don't?
Then they have to leave. But they will have stayed in the house for 5 years. You avoid all those huge foreclosure costs. You avoid the pain of these empty boarded up homes driving down everybody else's property value. You're not trying to prop up housing prices. That's not. But what you are trying to do is create a soft landing.
Let me ask you about one more that you mentioned fairly briefly in a column recently, which is the one from Glenn Hubbard and Chris Mayer at Columbia, where you would basically take every residential mortgage and refi it into a 30-year fixed at an interest rate of 5.25. That sounds really simple.
You're right. The problem with the Hubbard plan, I think, is that it doesn't create enough pain for the borrower. In other words, you're basically saying the lender has to take all the pain and the borrower has to take none of the pain. And that will create, I think, resentments in neighborhoods and on streets and in the country at large.
Well, back to the Freedom Recovery Plan, how likely do you think it is that this kind of rescue would or could even happen?
You know, I don't think it's terribly likely. It requires the passage of a law that lenders, especially the Wall Street guys, won't necessarily like. So, I mean, it's a long shot. But the point of the exercise here, you know, the reason I have been putting these plans on my blog is because I want discussion. even if the discussion ultimately says, well, that plan won't work, the important thing is to, you know, by God, we spend all this time worrying about the banks and worrying about the financial system, and I acknowledge that's important. But nobody is spending the time they need to spend on the root cause, which is home mortgages.
Joe Nocera is a business columnist for The New York Times. Thanks so much for going through these possible solutions with us. Maybe we'll check in with you in a few months to see what happened.
That would be great, Tess. Thanks so much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thriven.com. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
For the last few weeks around Marketplace, we've been asking, what are you doing? Yeah, you. And others who are deciding what changes to make in how they manage their money during this time of turmoil. Today we check in with a listener who's learned to shut out the noise.
My name is Nicholas Gaffney. I'm a partner in a public relations firm in San Francisco where I live with my wife, Marie, and son, Quinlan. I'm feeling fine because I think that I've exhausted the emotions connected to the financial markets. A few weeks ago, when the market started to become frenetic, I was very tense and traumatized, probably. I was in a state of shock. I couldn't believe that so many people could lose so much of what they worked so hard for so quickly. I didn't sleep very well for a couple days. I would check the computer or my Trello constantly. I would refresh the Google business page or the Yahoo Finance page that would show the Dow. You know, 100 times a day would not be an exaggeration. And probably when I was out and about, which a couple days I was traveling during when the crisis was at its peak, I would be checking my Trello 200 times a day. And I couldn't take it anymore. I just had my fill. I couldn't experience any more anxiety or any more shock. I was done. So now what I've been doing is I've been investing a regular amount almost every day that I'm doing because, one, I believe in the system, and two, at least gives me some sort of comfort that I'm at least making the best of an unfortunate situation. And there's a quote that I found the other day that I thought was appropriate for this. It's by C.S. Lewis, and it goes like this. Faith is the art of holding on to things your reason once accepted despite your changing moods. I mean, it would be so easy now to just say this system is terrible and to just walk away from it. Because it's frightening. But I had faith, and I think a lot of people in the country and the world had faith in our system, and I think that we're going to make some changes, and that faith will be found to be something that was good and true.
Tell us what you're doing and hear other voices from the series at marketplace.org. It is time for Getting Personal when we stop to answer some of your questions. And back with me is our own Chris Farrell, our economics and personal finance expert. You ready for some questions?
Well, I'm coming out of my financial foxhole, and yes, I'm ready.
Well, first, we have a call from Susanna, and she's in New Paltz, New York. She's been getting some unwelcome phone calls. What's going on, Susanna? Are these from the presidential candidate that you don't want to vote for?
If only. No, for the past several weeks, we've been getting debt collection phone calls for a woman named Deborah, who does not live here.
No Deborah at your house?
No Deborah at my house. And when I tell them that they are unfazed, I can't really get them off the line. And sometimes they just call right back. Then on Sunday, we got a robocall at 7:45 in the morning.
7:45 on a Sunday morning. We love debt collectors, don't we?
So, you know, I was wondering if there's any recourse or other than having to change one's phone number.
I don't know. Chris, this is a stumper.
It's a stumper. I have a couple of thoughts.
I understand why the debt collection business exists, but over the past decade, it has become increasingly unsavory and abusive. But here are your protections. There's this thing called the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. And if a debt collector calls you and you tell them, "I don't want to talk to you over the phone, I want to communicate with you in writing," they cannot call you on the phone. If they do call you on the phone, then they are violating, what's the acronym here? Let's see, FDCPA. They're violating the Fair Debt Collections Act, all right? So they are in violation.
But then she's just going to be getting a bunch of mail for someone who doesn't live there.
Right. What makes me feel bad is you haven't done anything wrong. And the ways to protect yourself from this annoyance is you have to do a lot of work. But there are things you can do. If you go online, you go on the internet, just type into your search engine a cease and desist letter. They're just sort of sample letters. And you send them a cease and desist letter via certified mail with a return receipt requested. And that gives you the proof that the letter was sent, that the letter was received. And then you could say, you say, "Hey, you know," and then you contact your state attorney general's office and you say, "I'm being abused." And state attorney general's offices have been taking a much stronger stand against the debt collection business because there have been so many abuses.
So it sounds like I have to call the robocall back, though, to get the information to mail them a letter to begin with.
Unfortunately, yes.
How awful.
Yeah. And it's terrible. It's awful. And I wish I could say, you know, there's some easier way of doing it. I mean, what I'm giving you is sort of like the whole menu. And then, of course, in your situation, you want to cease and desist because it's not even your debt. It's the wrong phone number.
And I suppose the most radical step would be to change your phone number.
With no forwarding number, right? That's the only way.
Correct. Yeah. It is an option. And sometimes people have to do it. I wish I could say that's not the case, but I do know people eventually have just thrown up their hands and changed their number.
Not great news to give you, but at least a few steps to maybe get these calls stopped.
Oh, well, thank you guys very much. It's lovely to talk.
All right. Good luck.
Isn't that frustrating, Tess?
Oh, I cannot imagine. I would just be going up the wall. All right, Chris. Next, we will go to an email from Bonabeth in Princeton, Indiana. And she's one of several people who've written in about their retirement investments with TIAA CREF. Chris, we've been doing kind of what seems like laundry lists of different retirement accounts and whether they're safe or not. Remind us who uses TIAA-CREF and is it okay?
Well, the sort of foundation of TIAA-CREF is teachers. And if you work at a university, more than likely you'll have TIAA-CREF, for example. It is an insurance company. It offers retirement savings plans. It is a bedrock of our retirement system. It is a very strong company. It is one of the three insurance companies that is rated AAA by all four rating bureaus.
I'm sorry to ask this, but wasn't AIG?
You've raised the question that haunts all of us in answering these issues. The unthinkable becomes thinkable. But TIAA-CREF is a very strong company. The insurance part, there's a lot of regulations because remember with AIG, there's no problem with the annuities. There's no problem with the retirement accounts. There's no problem with the insurance. The problem is associated with the parent company. If you go to the website of TIAA-CREF, which is TIAACREF.org, they've actually done a very good job from management listing out about their risks, how much they had in Lehman Brothers debt, for example, what was their exposure to Merrill Lynch, what was their exposure to Washington Mutual, AIG, Wachovia, and I believe the other one was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. So they've really done a nice job of laying out how much of their portfolio was. It's tiny. But they're addressing the concerns. They're addressing the issues. They're being very upfront. And in this world, the world that we're in, I think TIAA-CREF is a bedrock, strong institution.
And those are the topics we'll take for the moment. You can call us and leave your question for Chris at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or email us. You can find the Getting Personal link at our website, marketplace.org. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The ghosts of Wall Street's meltdown will no doubt haunt investors for years. The house of horror that is the New York Stock Exchange holds plenty of them. Ghosts are there to remind us of things we've done or undone, said or left unsaid. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we tour another building far from Manhattan that's said to be inhabited by spirits from the beyond.
My name is Janine Plummer. I own Austin Ghost Tours and Haunted Texas. I started the business about 12 years ago, and I was a tour guide. But at this point, I train tour guides. The purpose of the tours that we give are to change the myth, change the Hollywood myth versus what ghosts are, which are often comforting. Seeing an apparition is highly uncommon, and that is yet another myth, that you're going to see the lady in white coming through the room. Yes, that's a myth. In the thousands of ghost stories that I have listened to, the majority are not due to a murder or traumatic event. You know when it happens. If we're sitting in this room and all of a sudden there is an extremely strong smell of floral or perfume, and then it's gone, you never smell it again, that's actually a haunting. The second is the movement of an object. You put something on your shelf and then you come home one day and it's sitting on the kitchen counter. You have a necklace that is very important and it reminds you of your grandmother. Your grandmother gave it to you before she died. You keep it in your jewelry case. It's always there. One day you look, you're getting some earrings and it's not there. And it's not there for 6 months, and then one day it just reappears again. That's actually a haunting. You know, it's interesting. People will come on the tour and they'll want to see a full-bodied apparition. I want to see a ghost, you know, walking down the street or coming out the window of that building. And then after you explain the truth about haunting, their whole way of thinking has changed, and they're going like, oh, wait a minute, I've had an experience. I accept that there is something happening, and I believe it is predominantly good. What most surprised me about being a ghost tour guide was the number of people who had had someone that they loved die, and they wanted me to validate that, in fact, they could still be around. I make just shy of $50,000 a year. I have a rule amongst my friends and family. They're not allowed to say that I do the ghost tours because two things will happen. Immediately, you're unvalidated as a human being by people who don't believe, or someone is just dying to tell you their ghost story. My job contributes to society because it allows for a platform to talk about the fact that there is more than us to our physical bodies and to validate people who have experiences that support that.
Okay, that was Janine Plummer, owner of Austin Ghost Tours in Texas. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Dennis Foley. As the fallout from the financial crisis continues, one question lenders are asking is, how do you keep your borrowers from turning into ghosts if they fall behind on their loans? For a century-old bank here in California, the key is know your customers.
By going to their place of business, by being around them, by having a deposit relationship that lasts for years and years.
Our coverage of the financial crisis continues next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. This week, the Treasury Department finally started pumping cash directly to banks as part of the $700 billion Wall Street rescue package. The nine biggest banks in the country got a piece of the action. Some small regional banks also signed up, but others, well, they have no intention of taking taxpayer money. Don't want it, don't need it. Sounds kind of old-fashioned, doesn't it? Pull open the heavy brass doors of Farmers and Merchants Bank in Long Beach, California, and you're inside a building out of central casting. Tellers process checks and type notices under ornate chandeliers. The low hum of transactions bounces off the bank's marble walls and cathedral ceilings. CEO Henry Walker watches over it all from a second-floor balcony. He's the fourth generation of his family to run Farmers and Merchants.
This building was built by my great-grandfather, C.J. Walker, in 1923. And he purchased the land and built the building. At the time, it was the tallest building in Long Beach. The marble out here is Tennessee marble. Then you got Italian marble on the walls and of course, the gold leaf. You have the traditional brass teller cages that were typical of the 20s era. And we're quite proud of the building. We think it's one of the most beautiful buildings in Los Angeles County, for sure.
The sturdy, classic feel of Farmers and Merchants goes beyond the decor. Ken Walker, 82 years old, still heads the bank after 60 years of work. Customers can walk right up to the glass window in front of him that says loans.
He sits on the main floor behind the roll-top desk that was occupied by his grandfather, and I sit at the desk that was occupied by my grandfather.
I asked Henry Walker how the bank maintains its customers' trust when people are talking about mattresses as a safer depository.
Our first and foremost responsibility is to maintain a safe and sound deposit environment for our customers. And that is a philosophy that originated with my great-grandfather and has passed through my grandfather in the Depression to the current times that we're in. And we accomplish that with ultra-conservative loans, very conservative bond portfolio, and a capital in excess of 3 times our regulatory requirements.
How do you define an ultra-conservative loan? What is that?
We typically do not go beyond 50% loan-to-value on real estate. And where all the other banks were going 65, 70, 75, 80, we stayed at 50%. And then you deal with quality borrowers that you know. Because integrity and character are what come through in troubled times.
How do you know that?
You learn the integrity and character of your borrower by knowing who they are, by going to their place of business, by being around them, by having a deposit relationship that lasts for years and years. We see them at the charity functions. We might see them at the church. We might see them at the temple.
There are people who are actually flying in to Long Beach because of your reputation for safety. They're withdrawing from other banks.
We have had people from outside of California and in other parts of the market area that we don't serve bringing their money into the bank. While we appreciate it, they could probably just take their money and buy U.S. Treasuries with it and still be safe, but we're happy to safeguard their money and perform that function for them.
I wonder if it will be a trend toward going back to the community bank.
I do anticipate that community banks typically will function well and maintain strong balance sheets. We have to maintain strong balance sheets because in the case of the ultra-large banks, you know, the government steps in and safeguards them, don't they? The smaller banks, we need to take care of ourselves, and we do.
What did consumers do wrong here? Setting aside those who knowingly and willingly got into mortgages that they couldn't afford. Mm-hmm. But for the average, say, banking customer, where's their responsibility in all this?
The average banking customer does need to be responsible as to how they invest their money and where they put it. IndyMac was paying very high interest rates on their CDs. Mm-hmm. That should have been a clue because there's always a risk for high return. But a lot of consumers did nothing wrong. And they will be punished for the sins of others, won't they?
Do you think that we will enter an era, perhaps a new era, of conservative investing and banking on the part of consumers?
I hope the consumers pull back. I hope that the consumers manage their debt in a more conservative fashion. And that will cause our economy to slow. But I think it's something that we have to do as responsible consumers, as responsible parents and citizens. We have to manage our personal debt first and foremost responsibly.
Well, Henry Walker, CEO of Farmers and Merchants Bank here in Long Beach, thanks for inviting us in.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
It's time for more Getting Personal, and here we are again, Chris, right back where we belong. And first up, we have a question about what to do with a home equity line of credit. Joe in St. Paul is 40 years old, a small business owner. He was recently given some advice to take any available money from his HELOC, which is he's borrowed against his house.
Right.
And put it into a short-term CD because of this fear that the HELOC will be frozen by the bank or reduced because of the credit crunch. Is it ever a good idea to borrow money against your house and put it in another investment?
No, absolutely not. Let's just simplify this. The answer is don't be borrowing against your HELOC right now unless you have a really good reason. My feeling is that Joe does not have a really good reason. Someone has said it's out of the fear that your HELOC will be frozen or reduced in a credit crunch. So what? You don't want to be adding debt to your balance sheet in the environment we're in. You want to be paying down debt in the environment that we're in. You want to be building up your savings. Bottom line, I'm getting this message. You're getting the message. We're all getting this message about, well, you might want to borrow against your home because you don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
No, you don't want to borrow against your home because you don't know what's going to happen. We're living in a world of uncertainty. We're living in a world where the unthinkable is happening. In that world, you want to reduce your risks. You want to reduce your vulnerability. You want your household to be secure. So don't be borrowing because someone's telling you of some sort of fear that something may happen. So what? It's okay.
And if your HELOC is getting frozen or reduced, then it probably means you shouldn't have been borrowing against it anyway because the value of your home has probably gone down.
Well, the other thing is it has nothing to do with you probably also. It has something to do with this financial condition of the bank. And a year from now, 2 years from now, the situation's going to change. So again, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on about panic. There's a lot of fear. Well, what if, what if, what if? Well, if you want to have some panic, you want to have some fear, the only thing that you should fear is if you're too indebted. That's the one thing you should fear in the environment that we're in. That's what you should focus on, not on borrowing extra money on the off chance that you won't be able to borrow extra money and you shouldn't be borrowing extra money anyway.
Amen. All right, finally, we have a call from Bill in Minneapolis, and he's retiring next year, and he's very concerned about inflation affecting his ability to live on what he has saved for retirement. So he's heard about a way to protect against that. What is it, Bill?
As you said, I'll be retiring next year. I'll have a pension of about $54,000 a year from the state of Minnesota. I have heard that there is something called a TIP, a Treasury Inflation Protected Security. And I have been told that that might be my way of protecting that $54,000 from inflation, that I could buy what are called strips off of these TIPS that would pay me each year of maturity the amount that I had lost through inflation.
Well, Chris, we talk a lot on the program about TIPS, and you're a big proponent of Treasury inflation-protected securities, but what about strips off TIPS?
I love TIPS, and I also think you can, you know, build some diversification in there, buying some short-term treasury bills, which will also protect you against inflation, and you'll have a little more access to the money depending on what's happening. I'm not so sure I would build a whole program around STRIPS. Now, just for, as a definition, STRIPS is an acronym. Separate trading of registered interest in principal of securities, i.e., strips. And brokers can buy a U.S. Treasury security. And in essence, what it is they create what in essence is zero coupon bond. You get your return when the bond matures. So it's a really good way if 5 years from now you had some payment that needed to be made and you knew what that payment was, you can buy the strips that mature in 5 years, protected against inflation, and your payment goes there. That's where they really work particularly well. But I think for you, it'd probably just be simpler to build yourself a diversified fixed income portfolio with TIPS and some treasury securities in there and perhaps a couple of certificates of deposit, which will also, taken all together, will protect your portfolio against inflation.
Do you know of anyone who actually does sell strips off of TIPS? Are these simply not traded?
Oh, no. You can go to any major financial institution that offers securities services online, discount. A lot of banks, major banks, offer securities brokerage services. A lot of major mutual fund companies offer brokerage services. And any of them would be able to buy or sell strips for you if you wanted to go that route. I just keep my life a lot easier, frankly, with buying the actual TIPS.
Okay.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions on this week's show. But our voicemail is here to take your calls 24 hours a day. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. And we're available online anytime as well. Write to us at the Getting Personal link on marketplace.org. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice and for the tips on strips.
You're welcome, Tess.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. As we've been saying, for weeks, our inbox has been flooded with your questions about the financial crisis and how to navigate it. But you've also written in with your thoughts about our coverage. Time for your comments, compliments, and complaints. Several of you chided us on the title of our special show 2 weeks ago. We called it, Who Can You Trust? Grammar 101, wrote Aaron Hoyland from St. Peter, Minnesota. You is the subject, he says. Can trust is the verb phrase. Who, whom should then be in the objective case? So we should have asked, whom do you trust? We were going for what you might call common usage, but consider our knuckles wrapped. Economist Chris Thornburg made an appearance on the show recently, and guest host Scott Jagow asked him, when might be a good time to buy a house?
It's the right place. It's the right time. It's the right school district, because your wife won't shut up.
Oh, no, he didn't. Well, to be fair, which apparently we weren't in the editing process, he did say, or husband, right after that. But Betsy Levin of San Francisco had something to say about what went on the air.
I personally cringed and then went straight to the computer. In my opinion, it was a huge gaffe on the part of the show to leave that comment in.
Valley Power of Trinity Center, California, had props for our conversation with three small business owners on last week's program. She says of our panel, they reminded me that if everybody would disconnect themselves from the hysterical mode and begin to think creatively about what they really need, as opposed to what some advertiser tells them they need, then we can find our way out of the Walmart credit card morass and get through this. We'll come back smarter and stronger. Let's hope so. And finally, cue the ukulele. In my recent feature about a high school econ class, teacher Ron Settle reminded his students that if he could predict the future of the financial world, well, he wouldn't be in the classroom. He'd be on a beach sipping Mai Tais. Neva Karras of Honolulu, Hawaii, called in with an offer.
They wouldn't need a crystal ball to get to our beaches and our Mai Tais, so come on down. Our tourism is off big time. Should we be handing out crystal balls with directions to Waikiki Beach?
Yes. Keep your comments coming. Just go to marketplace.org and click on contact. this week, we say goodbye to a longtime staffer here at Marketplace Money. Producer Nancy Fargali is leaving us for other pursuits. So we brought her in to talk about her 4+ years in personal finance. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Tess.
So we told you that we wanted to just kind of talk to you about your time on the show. But in the spirit of Halloween, we've got something a little spookier for you. We've got a quiz.
I knew this was going to be it. I did not prepare. This is gotcha journalism.
You ready?
Yeah.
All right. First question. What is the LIBOR?
The LIBOR is the bank rate that is set to allow banks to borrow money from each other.
Very good. And where is it based?
London.
Excellent. Well, here with another question is a guest star on today's show, a familiar voice to you and to listeners.
Hey, Nancy, it's Kai. Kai Rizdahl from Marketplace. Listen, what is a good credit score and why is it so important anyway?
The credit score is basically a score that they look at your credit history, your credit transactions, student loans, mortgages, and the three credit bureaus come up with a score that allows you to borrow money for a car, home, refinancing, mortgages. And so you really want to have a good credit score because that means you'll have a lower interest rate.
All right. Very well done.
Thank
Very
you.
Very well done. Okay.
Thank you.
2 out of 2.
Okay.
And finally, Nancy,
okay.
Someone who really hopes you've learned a lot during your time on the show so you don't show up at his doorstep needing to move back in someday.
Hello, Nancy. I am your dad.
All right. You recognize that voice, right?
Yes, that's my dad.
Okay. Well, here's his quiz question for you.
Assume that I have $13,000 in credit debt and $20,000 in student loans. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of saving, but I really want to buy a big house next year. What should I do first?
He picks up the phone, calls his parent, mom or dad, and asks, can I borrow money for a down payment? Thanks, Dad.
Well done.
Thank you. And can I just say one thing?
Mm-hmm.
This has been an absolute pleasure for me. I've been here for almost 4.5 years. And when I first started, I had no idea that the financial market would collapse and that the Red Sox would win the World Series twice. So it's been a wonderful 5-year period. Thank you.
Go Sox. Nancy, we're going to miss you. Good luck.
I'm going to miss all of you, too. Bye.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, we continue our coverage of the fallout from the financial crisis. If you're behind on your mortgage, maybe it's time for a new listing. Something along the lines of wanted, roommate.
I mean, I made a list of things I could do to bring in more income. And one of them was renting out the room.
Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali for the final time. With Jim Wallace, Stephen Hoffman, Eve Troh, and the rest of the Marketplace staff, our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. American Public Media.